The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Today on The Cyber Show, Kevin fights off child pornography. Fake invoices pay off. Hank goes extra legal. Sean gives us the strawberry. Ira collaborates with foreign intelligence operatives. And cybersecurity is made a joke of? Well, all this and more on today's Cyber Show.
The thing about me telling jokes is kind of like whiskey, you know, the first time you drink it, you get sick.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Coming up this month, the Angel to Exit monthly advisory meeting is Tuesday the 10th of January at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. To sign up, join the mailing list at a2e.co. That's the letter A, the number 2, letter E, dot C-O. This month's all.net member forum will be on Tuesday the 10th of January at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. This month, we're going to discuss influence operations, trust architecture, and AI and cybersecurity. Don't miss it. To sign up, go to all.net, that's all.net, and join the mailing list. And welcome to 2023.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. Researchers have discovered a major cyber vulnerability in the popular AI program ChatGPT. The issue allows hackers to gain access to sensitive information through the chat function. It's unclear at this time how widespread the issue is or how it can be mitigated. We will bring you more updates as they become available. This news was written by, you guessed it, ChatGPT.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. It's the beginning of 2023, and of course, at the beginning of any year, it's time to review the best jokes of the year before. So we have here the top cybersecurity jokes of 2022. Why'd the park ranger issue the hacker a ticket? Answer, he didn't have a fishing license. Okay, here's one from outer space. Astronauts use Linux because they can't open Windows in space. All right, here's another one. Now, this is a little bit unkind. I went to an Alzheimer's support forum site. There was no button to log in. They only had I forgot my password. All right, how about this one? How can you tell the difference between your IT team and a cyber criminal? Answer, well, only one knows what they're doing. How about this one? When a foreign government released a program that cripples computers across a nation, it's called a cyber attack. When a corporation does it, it's called Windows Vista. All right, well, naming names, of course. Why did the network defender never open up to anyone about how he felt? Well, he believed in zero trust. All right, well, we'll come back with some more jokes from last year later in the show. This is a little segment of the show we call Cyber Cops. Cyber Cops are the police officers and other law enforcement officials who police the cyber world. And this is their story.
Okay, welcome back, Kevin, the original Cyber Cop, right, who formed the Cyber Cop portal and all of that, trained Cyber Cops at Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, was in the New York Electronic Crimes Task Force before it became the National Electronic Crimes Task Force. And I worked with you at FLETC trying to train some of these students. And then I don't know if you remember, you know, it must have been in the late 90s, we had a bunch of Cyber Cops that came out to Sandia National Labs for training. Do you remember that event?
Oh, absolutely. Unforgettable. Still got some video from that. It was local coverage. Yeah, that was a great experience, Fred. And you were doing some really advanced stuff. I think you were calling.
Well, let's not worry about me. Let's talk about the cyber cops and the whole incident. So let's just walk through a couple of things that you did there with the cyber cop.
Well, we had a classroom there, and we carried out a lot of interesting. Well, actually, unintended, but there were some investigations that ended up popping up as a result of our cyber cops getting on the internet and finding people that were engaged in putting on, let's put it this way, illegal pictures of underage kids online.
Yeah, child pornography. Yeah. You know, so I had to get permission. When you say not planned, I had to get permission, you know, from Sandia to allow us to go out on the internet. So now you're going out on the internet through my whatever anonymized network, you know, concealed by a national laboratory, a bunch of cyber cops. And they're out there doing investigations, and you're teaching them how to do stuff, and we're training them on how to use this and how to use that. And along the way, they're going out and finding stuff, right? Which was, okay. So besides finding stuff, so what happened after that to the stuff that they found?
Well, there was at least, as I recall, Mike or Mark Menz, the famous Menz brothers. I'm pretty sure they had at least one prosecution that was brought as a result of that. But I wasn't able to follow it through to the courtroom and whatnot.
Right. So besides that, there was also another side effect was, I don't know if you remember, there's a cyber cop out in New York, and we're not going to name names, who ended up, you know, we had surveillance equipment that we had created using our bootable CDs. And so they started to use that in investigations, criminal and civil investigations, because it was covert surveillance. You know, you couldn't see it on the network, but it was listening to what was going on. So they started to watch some of that stuff and picked up some number of criminal prosecutions that way. From that piece of that device that we had created at Sandia under some other programs for some other folks. And then another one that came back was breaking encryption system. So there's at least one case where they came back. We had a network of computers that we had configured in a large parallel processor to break certain encryption methodologies that were, let's say, flawed. And so we ended up, I don't know if you know this one, we ended up providing a password to be able to decrypt a bunch of messages. And I think the password we provided was like, you know, 800 characters, you know, like, you know, 6#, lowercase a, capital B, RMQ, and so forth, right? So when asked how we got this password, the answer was lucky guess. Because that's what we were doing. We were maybe methodologically guessing passwords, but, you know, so lucky guess was the good answer. And that held up, right? They had no problem taking to court and prosecuting successfully.
Well, Fred, since I'm all about what I call being a trusted introducer, I do want to mention some names, because a lot of what was done in this was not done by me. It may have been done through me, but not necessarily by me. I think...
I understand. Credit where due. But I don't mention the names of people I was involved in investigations with, because some of the people that got investigated might decide that they wanted to come back and get rid of some people, and we don't want to support that, right? So one of the interesting things that came out of that process was getting involved in child pornography investigations. And this is an area where I couldn't tolerate it. I got involved in one or two investigations, but I couldn't handle it. I got physically ill and could not do that work. Do you have any insight into the problems that people have doing that work? And, you know, how do you train them to do that work? And how do you deal with those issues?
Well, that's not an issue that I had really any direct involvement with. I'm certainly aware of it, because I've spoken to a number of cyber cops who, at some point, they get so, you know, the old idea, when you wrestle with a pig, you get dirty. Well, if you deal with these pornographers and whatnot, it's got to have a dramatic adverse effect on one's psyche. And I know that's a problem. I'm not sure who is best able to deal with that, but I've always wondered why we should let anybody get involved in that for more than a couple of years at a time, rather than making it a lifetime occupation or avocation.
Yeah, I couldn't tolerate a year. I couldn't tolerate a couple of months. I a couple of investigations, and I just had it. You know, I would be crying, you know, talking to my wife about it and all these things. It's just horrible.
I do want to mention this, Fred, because one of the things they started doing, and the person I wanted to mention, his name is Mike Garrity. Mike was with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. He's now the cyber czar, if you will, for the state of New Jersey. Mike was working there when they finally were able to do hashes of these images. And so you didn't have to sit there all day long and look at these horrific images, but you could look at hashes that represented those images. And that was
right.
So
this technique is, you take a cryptographic hash of the images that are on the disk, you compare it to a known set of child pornography or whatever you're looking for. And if the hashes match, then that's a presumptive positive. So you don't have to look at all this crap. But once you get those presumptive positives, before you're going to actually put it into court, you actually do have to look. But at least it saves all this other, you know, painful stuff, you know, and you minimize the amount of stuff.
Well, you know, so kids at home, right? You know, so the movie Hackers came out in 1995. right? So what you're hearing is all the stories that went in behind this, right? You know, Fred, I may have told you this one, but it might, you know, Borderware. We were going public, you know, so you could see the fire, you know, that's how I got into the firewall industry. And I got contacted by the producers or director or somebody from, who was making a Hollywood movie starring Sandra Bullock called The Net. And they said, okay, want to run the security part of the plot by you and see if it makes sense. And I said, no, that's not how computers work at all. Right. I thought about it and I wrote up an alternative, but actually technically makes sense that they didn't use. Think about those two movies, Hackers. Everyone remembers Hackers. That was a great film. The Net disappeared, you know, never seen again. You got to get it right. You know, over time, these stories sound like Agatha Christie, right?
You know, Hackers was pretty realistic. I mean, there was a lot of good comedy in it, which I loved. You know, the thing where he looks something up in the book, how do you get past this kind of lock? And, you know, Robert Redford sitting there and he listens in the ear and he says, okay. And then he kicks the door in. Oh, that works.
You know, we're talking about Kevin here, right? And I'm thinking about Dick Francis, this great British novelist, you know, wrote dozens of Agatha Christie-like books. But he was first a champion jockey. So he wrote about horse racing. You know, all these books about, you know, Agatha Christie sort of murder mysteries embedded in a horse racing context. Then he and his wife, you know, got their private pilot's license, bought a plane, and started an air taxi service. So wrote some books about that, right? And you can just feel, I love all those books, and it's like Kevin. It's like Hackers. Yeah,
they're real because they're written by somebody that actually had the experience, not by somebody who's just making up a story.
Right, because it's in the nuance. And security, cloak and dagger stuff, it's all in the nuance. That's why it's so fascinating. And in real life, yeah, it really is that fascinating. It's just a hoot.
Sort of. When you try to put it on film, this is one of the big problems. They try to put stuff on film that shows cybersecurity. So they always have this screen with stuff flashing past on it, like that means something. And I watch these things and I say, oh, no, that's the wrong kind of system. They're talking about a Windows box. That's a Linux command set there. So it ruins it maybe for me. But how much excitement can you get out of a bunch of stuff flashing by on the screen? And the answer is not much. So that gets about a quarter of a second. In the meanwhile, the guy actually doing that work has been sitting there for, you know, 12 days, not 3 seconds.
Right.
Staring at all this crap going past and figuring it out and writing algorithms. So it's, in a lot of ways, the technical side of it is a lot more boring than what you imagine from the movies. And they talk about this as the CSI effect. People expect, juries expect that you're going to have incredibly good evidence. You know, oh, well, you got his computer. You must know everything about his life and all this stuff. The reality is trying to find stuff on those computers, the content is not everything that's there. Tying it all together is not trivial and so forth. It takes a lot of time and effort to get a little bit of information that way.
Well, it's like the old cliche about being a soldier, right? Which is 99%, you know, hard work and tedium, you know, and 1%, you know, action and excitement and terror and so forth. And this security is the same way. It's a lot of work. You know, it doesn't go, you know, as you're saying, it doesn't necessarily go well in 90 minutes. You know, sometimes it can. You know, I got to call out Mark Rogers, who's done great work with the show Mr. Robot. You know, our friend Garrett Gee was on that, I think, at some point, right?
Was he? Garrett's awesome. In fact, I was going to have Garrett on the show when I got a chance to do that. But, you know, he's not ready to keel over like we are. So we have time to get him on.
Let's go on to the sadder part of this, the issues of child pornography and search and seizure and so forth. That
technology in the cyber arena has made it tremendously better for cyber cops and allowed cyber cops to amplify their capacity to do search and seizure and analysis by orders of magnitude and removed the real pain of this process. My goodness. So there are so many other areas where we have this concept of triage that we don't seem to apply.
You know, it's hard to listen to this sort of thing. You know, Kevin brought me to the HCCIA, the High Tech Crime Investigation Association. And that's where I met a lot of folks who work the day job of child exploitation and tying it down. You're right. And, you know, there's a 1,000-yard stare. You know, people who do this sitting around having a couple of beers in the evening, and it's, you know, trying to think past that, right? You know, because the reality is that in life, in security, in business, we deal with, you know, sometimes things are really hard to deal with. We have to be able to stop and figure it out because it's important. Trying to emotionally back away from that issue, but how do you deal with things that are that hard? You know, as I'm listening to that piece, this everybody's, you know, there's too much information to deal with in the first place. There's too much of that information to deal with in any case. And the psychological impact of humans dealing with it calls for tools to allow them to do their job without damaging them.
Yeah, I think it's one of those many cases, and you can find lots of them, where, especially in the policing area, you just encounter horrible things. And, you know, we put so much on police, and you think that in the cyber arena, it's not that way and that it's safe. You know, it's all white collar or something, but it's not. And in fact, one of the things that we did with Kevin was called digital officer safety. Because normally any police training, safety, you have to train them how to safely, you know, deal with criminals, right? Who are trying to shoot at them or beat them up, whatever. And it turns out in the digital arena, you have to do the same thing, right? So somehow assuring the safety of the officers is critically important.
You know, these things typically tend to go, it's more than about just that, you know, with misinformation, disinformation, people's feelings, you know, the emotional states of people are being manipulated on mass scales for all sorts of different reasons, because our tools are what they are these days, and not yet, you know, what they're obviously going to be at some future point. And with a, you know, thank God we have a focus, you know, nationally and globally now on mental health and so forth. You know, my 20-something-year-old kids and, you know, have helped me, and I think they're helping my generation realize that, you know, it actually matters. So as you put these things together, we need to break down how you have massive global communication system without damaging people's brains at all level. You know, not just people working in security, but how do you do that without...
You know, and it's not yet another part of the future we haven't figured out. I think we're going to have so many things we haven't figured out that we're never going to have it all figured out, which is the nature of things, right?
Which is good. We'll never get bored.
We'll be telling more stories from Cyber Cops in our next show. So don't miss it. Next Wednesday, 9 a.m. Pacific time, KMBY, 1240 a.m. And on the web at thecybershow.co. Okay, here are some more pretty interesting cyber jokes from 2022. Cybersecurity is like an onion. There's layers, and at some point you start to cry. Here's another one. As a kid, I used to watch The Wizard of Oz and wonder how someone could talk if they didn't have a brain. Then I got on social media. Here's a good one. Why do you look at your phone like that? Well, I sneezed while initializing facial recognition. We'll have some more jokes later in the show.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit free monthly advisory session is Tuesday, the 10th of January at 9 a.m. Pacific time. To participate, join the mailing list at a2e.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. Here's an interesting fraud that we see coming out more often. It's an email sent to the individual. The subject is...
Order confirmation.
It contains an...
invoice.
In this case, for...
Microsoft Defender.
With an address...
732 Masonic Drive, Kingston, 30145 George, United States.
You might note with interest that there is no such state in the United States as George, and there is no zip code associated with it. What the heck address is this? Well, you know, not all these guys are the sharpest tools in the shed, and some of them don't know culturally about the United States and how things work.
Amount, $399.99.
Now, according to the Microsoft website,
after your 1 month free trial is $99.99 per year.
So the price is way wrong, of course. Billed to
Microsoft user.
Of course, I'm not actually a Microsoft user, but even if I was, probably that's not the right bill to for an invoice. With an invoice number and an invoice date and a username and a due date and a confirmation number. And it looks just like a real invoice with all the things a real invoice might reasonably have in it. It also provides...
In case you did not make this payment, please call our billing support team at 1-845-307-6256.
And if you call that number, of course, they will answer your questions and take your money. And of course, it has an urgency message at the bottom.
Note, you have 24 hours to raise a dispute in the PayPal Inc. at billing support team for cancellation and refund.
And of course, there is no such order. It's just an invoice trying to get, in this case, me to pay them something. And of course, they've sent it out to massive email addresses, and I've gotten several copies to several of my email addresses. Generally speaking, people have a tendency to pay invoices that look legitimate or dispute invoices they think are illegitimate. And in the process, they end up engaging with scammers of all sorts who one way or the other try to take their money. Remember, this is a statistical fraud. They send out massive numbers of emails, each one looking like it's to you, the recipient. And they're counting on some people to say, oh my goodness, and end up paying them for their fraudulent invoice. Now, this particular example had lots of flaws that were very obvious. But some of the more advanced scammers have fewer flaws that are less obvious. Almost always there's one flaw or another that you can find if you look and think. But they're not counting on you thinking. They're counting on you not thinking, becoming concerned, calling their number, and then they've got you. My advice, when you get these sorts of things, unless you know it's a legitimate invoice from a legitimate place, don't even think about it. It's spam, it's junk, ignore it. When it seems legitimate, it's somebody you've done business with before. Oh, it's a PayPal account. Oh, it's Microsoft. You name it. That doesn't mean it's legitimate. Legitimate companies communicate with you through legitimate channels that they already have. The other thing is, independently use your cell phone or however you contact them to contact the vendor. Don't trust the phone number that's provided. Don't trust the email address that's provided. Don't click on the link that's provided. These are all things intended to drive you down their fraud path and ultimately to turn your money into their money. This is the fake invoice scam. Don't fall for it. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Time, the unidirectional dimension.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Time, the unidirectional dimension.
Now, on to our next service provider. Hank, the lawyer that's not a liar, welcome back. Well, let's talk a little bit about things that might or might not end up going to court.
Well, you know, there are lots of ways to resolve disputes. I mean, people come to lawyers, and it's I think sometimes the people mistakenly think, and sometimes the lawyers mistakenly think that, okay, you know, what we have to do now is file a lawsuit, when sometimes there are things one can do in the market. There are different offers one can make to cultivate a business relationship that maybe is not hasn't gone totally south yet. You can share revenues. There's lots of things you can do to resolve disputes that don't necessarily involve litigation. A lot of times litigation is a necessity, and when a case needs to be litigated, it needs to be litigated. Some cases, lawyers will say, probably truthfully, some cases actually need to be tried. That's probably true. But extrajudicial means to resolve disputes, you know, most disputes are resolved that way before they get to lawyers. So,
well, when you say before they get to lawyers, after they get to lawyers, most of the cases I've seen end up settling. So they never actually get to where you're in front of a jury, because by the time you get that close, you can come to an agreement, right?
Yeah, I forget what, you know, von Clausewitz said, whoever it was, saying, you know, war is another, it's a tool of diplomacy. It's a form of negotiation. Litigation, I think, is, or certainly can be much the same way. I mean, it's ideally with litigation, you're looking to develop some sort of leverage or advantage that you can then parlay into a more favorable negotiated resolution, because most of the time you're going to end up negotiating a resolution eventually, and there are far more options earlier on before you've spent some of the resources that you could use before you've spent them on lawyers.
Fair enough. All right. So look, Hank, obviously we've discussed this for over many years on the various things we've done working together. And we're likely to discuss a lot more in the future. So hopefully we'll be able to call on you again and talk more about the legal issues, especially in the cyber arena, where obviously the show is the Cyber Show. So you know, that's going to be the subject matter.
For sure. Always happy to talk to you, Fred. It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Hank points out what I think is sort of fundamentally true, that you only go to the final aspect of the legal solution when you have to. And that's really largely what agreements are about, right? That, and I see a lot of startup companies in almost any arena that just don't pay attention to legal issues in advance and end up getting in trouble because they're not paying attention to them. And then they end up in these disputes that are unnecessary, and they end up talking to lawyers, which is expensive and time consuming. I think it's sort of fundamental that you go to extra legal means. Does that make sense?
So, right. You know, at the end of the day, it's all about relationships. You know, when lawyers get involved, it's either because you're trying to craft the right contract of the right express relationship, or because you're not sure if it was. So it's always best, if you can, you know, to look at the relationship and try to figure it out. But legal steps are not necessarily, don't have to be particularly aggressive. It's just say, you know, we can't figure this out. We're going to sit down with lawyers and make it work.
So I've had a fair amount of experience in the beginning of a relationship with trying to create a contract and having people, let's just say, not want to bother to go through a contract process and finding it offensive that you're going to force some legalism on them. And I'm like, hey, what is it about this that you disagree with? If there's something here you don't like, it presumably is something you don't intend to do, which means we don't have a meeting of the mind. So tell me now what you're not going to do or what you're going to do, right? Does that make sense?
Well, you know, this is one of the reasons I like, it's you make compromises. And on the legal side, you have to balance it. With a startup that I was part of, we had the best Silicon Valley lawyers after our first partnership agreement, and the potential partner had, you know, some, their lawyers had some questions with that. They proposed some text, perfectly reasonable. 10, 12, 20 partners later, there was always some other piece of legal text, you know, that's perfectly reasonable that wasn't there. So on the one hand, you can chase this rabbit hole forever. On the other hand, if you're not going to figure out the relationship at the beginning, matter of its business or friendship or marriage, right?
I use standard agreements. You know, I've been doing it for a lot of years, and I know just what should go in there and what I don't care about. And if you care about something, you can add it. But otherwise, and I've done this because I've encountered those situations. Had lawyers I worked with long ago that knew all the situations because they had been in the law business for a long time, and they had standard setups for agreement. Here's all the things you talk about in this kind of contract. And nowadays, you would think that with AI and with all of the fusion of information from everywhere, we would have fully complete contracts that cover every possibility, but apparently not. It's never going to happen.
You know, it is theoretically, but not fundamentally possible. Right. You cannot forecast every possible case. You know, you can't forecast, you know, how human language words are going to be interpreted in every single case. You know, you just want clarity at the beginning. You know, you'd like to honestly express how you expect this to work out and have something to come back to when you can't, you know, agree by normal means. You know, help us work through this up to litigation and prosecute, you know, all of it. But typically it's a way of working. I always see legal text as code. It looks like software to me. If this, then that, therefore, you know, so how much code burden do you want to have and how diligently do you want to manage it?
So you have failure modes and you're willing to accept the risk by not trying to spend the next 6 months filling out what happens at 2 o'clock in the afternoon as opposed to 2:30 when I feel
right.
Yeah, obviously you don't want to codify it to that level, but in some broad strokes, you want coverage of the fundamentals.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Our next All.net Free Members Forum will be held January 10th at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. Topics for January include influence operations, AI and cybersecurity, and trust architecture. To participate, join the mailing list at All.net. That's ALL.net.
All right, here are some more cyber jokes from 2022. The client asked me, so did you catch the hacker? And I said, no, he just ran somewhere. Why did the programmer go to rehab? Well, he was addicted to coding. Why did the programmer leave the camping trip early? There were too many bugs. What are a chief information security officer's two biggest cybersecurity fears? Well, the first one is everyone who works at the company, and the second one is everybody who doesn't. Boy, I'll tell you what, you know, people are afraid of viruses everywhere today. Just to give you an example, I mean, today I coughed on my monitor and my antivirus software started running. After a life of cybercrime, how the heck does a hacker get into heaven? Well, that's easy. The password hasn't been changed in 2,000 years. All right, we're going to take a break now and go back to something interesting.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Well, now, on to our next company. Sean from PowerGrow, welcome back.
Okay, so let's talk about strawberries. And you're talking about putting these around, you know, big metropolitan areas. And I live in a place where we get strawberries, you know, much of the year out of the ground. But is this going to displace a lot of things in the prior agricultural world? Is it going to replace farm workers, migrant workers? You know, what's going to be replaced? What's going to replace with?
Well, we still need workers, right, in the greenhouses. They just have a much safer and better work environment. We've got a project under development in Hawaii, and I've been over to the Big Island about a half dozen times, and not once, typically when I travel, I go into grocery stores and see how the local produce is. Not once in the last six trips did I find strawberries in the grocery store in Hawaii, and I went up to the produce buyer and asked him. I said, why can't I find strawberries here? He said, by the time they get here from Mexico or California, they're already rotting and molding, and we'd rather not sell a product to a customer than sell them a bad product. So
yeah, but that's not going to be true anymore.
No, and that's the key, is we can now go into areas where you just can't grow locally for whatever reason, or they're typically shipped in from elsewhere, and grow locally year round.
So let's talk about local growing. So with better working conditions, presumably, and the increase in efficiency, you should be able to pay people more. So you could have reasonably skilled workers working for high pay, local economy. So they're working locally. So you're just, you know, saving all over the place and generating benefits for the local economy everywhere you go.
Yeah, it's you know, I didn't know what impact investing or ESG was when we started the company, but we hit every leg of the stool, from local job creation to water conservation, land preservation, renewable power generation, carbon reduction. But at the end of the day, business is about people. We're a veteran centric company, and so part of our goal is to put as many veterans to work as possible inside greenhouses. We found there's actually a number of studies showing that veteran mental health is really positive. Mental health is conducive to indoor grow environments. So we're piping in music for the plants and for the workers.
Okay, music for the plants. I don't know the science behind that, but I'm pretty sure for the workers it's good. So you're talking about, for example, most disabled veterans would have no problem doing these things, right?
Right. And we want to design the greenhouses so that they can accommodate people, whether they be in a wheelchair or have some type of physical issue.
Okay, now we had talked about this before. When you locate these things just in the periphery of a big city, the prices for the land are very low. But as you succeed, you're generating power, net power at some point. You're generating food, you're generating jobs, and people are going to start to build around you. And eventually, you know, you're going to be in a very high priced area with your greenhouse. So what happens next?
Well, it's almost like dairy farms, where you'll see a concentric circle of dairy farms around a major population center. So dairy farmers, the motto is they buy the land by the acre and sell it by the foot. As development encroaches upon the dairy farm, we have that same opportunity to take undervalued, underutilized land, repurpose it into optimal farmland with indoor grow environments. But they can also build around us, right? We're not the worst neighbors to have in the world. And that's why you're seeing greenhouses being developed in urban areas as well as suburban and rural areas.
Yeah. So I was going to ask about that. You could presumably put these greenhouses, if they're not all that heavy, on top of other buildings.
Yeah, there's one greenhouse company that does that. What they found is it's difficult from a permitting standpoint to get that done. It takes a long time. And our permitting process in Texas for this first large project has been extremely fast. So one of the benefits of taking urban or rural land that's near major population centers is typically getting things permitted very quick and relatively inexpensive. But yeah, we've seen greenhouses built on top of other buildings. There's been a really innovative greenhouse in Jackson Hole, Wyoming that's designed. It's a vertical greenhouse with multiple layers that's next to a parking garage. The Hawaii site's on a former naval air station that we're looking at right now. So we can repurpose land that typically would not have other good uses for it and turn it into optimal produce land.
I love it. And there's sort of no end to your ability to do this. You're getting such an advantage over existing growing areas. Now, are you going to put farmers out of business, or is there a limitation on what you can reasonably grow?
I was born on a farm. Our job is to keep farmers in business. You know, the one thing a farmer can't control is the weather. And the way they deal with that is they typically plant 20 or 30% more produce than they intend to sell to market, just to account for weather fluctuations. So our greenhouses end up being the greatest insurance policy a farmer could ever deploy. It gives them the ability to grow year round in a very controlled environment.
Fascinating. All right. 1,000 more questions.
So again, two of my favorite words, you know, systemic and incremental success, right? You know, that you don't have to, when it's time for things to really change, you'll find that it's not doing it perfect that is successful. It's doing it better. Right. And, you know, combine those two questions you just asked, like, who has all this real estate growing stuff? I don't know. Farmers, you know, take an acre of that and gets, you know, implements systems like this, you've got the land.
Yeah, or 5 or 10 acres. These, so yeah. There is a minimum scale, right? You sure. Try to do this in your living room is not going to be feasible. I mean, this is a tremendous automation. If you watch the videos, and the videos are on their website, you can watch the videos of these things working. And you know, high-tech agriculture is, it's not cheap, it's not simple, but it, you know, it's one of those things where when you get the engineering and stuff scaled up, you get these economies of scale and these other benefits. And it's just something that didn't happen to agriculture when it happened to cars and other manufactured goods. And it's because I think that we hadn't evolved the science and the engineering far enough to do it in that living environment of agriculture, which is way, way more complex than the sort of artificial environment of making things out of metal and so forth.
Well, and that's the systemic part of it, right? You know, that, and again, this guy gives me, you know, great, good comfort levels, you know, grew up on a farm, understands how this works. You're creating jobs, you're adding value. You know, you have to look at the stakeholders in your business environment. You know, it has very little to do with technology. There's lots of technology that works to do lots of things, but does it all come together? And so inside, yeah. You know, their product, you know, what they're building, you know, you've got a systemic look at things, and the deployment is, you know, is systemic as well. Real estate, you know, interest, human interest, you know, veterans. Jobs, right?
Yeah, it's one of those things, and you're right about the extent to which it's systemic. And his background, you know, he's not an engineering background, he's written programs, but you know, his background is in business development. And so I think there's a certain number of years in business development before you get to the sophistication level where you can deal with these issues. And he was in an operational technology environment, you know, doing business development there for years when he worked. So the combined life experience of the individuals is one of those things that builds a lot of confidence. And I'll talk about it in a different way. It reduces risk. And the fact that I've thrown at him here 20 or 30 different questions that are sort of in different dimensions, and he's thought through every one of them, right? And he's doing things for a reason. And I see so many startups where, you know, they're just sort of, they picked one. Oh, I think this looks interesting. I'll do that. And they can't answer all those questions.
And it is interesting. And they can do that. It's like, you know, so? Does anybody care?
Right. And the other thing you said, it gets to this point where all of a sudden it works. There's another aspect to that. And we saw that also, you know, in another one of the companies that presented. If you can get a 95% improvement and you can scale that, then that last 5% isn't going to matter for a long time. It's going to be very easy to disrupt with that 95% change as opposed to trying to disrupt that 95% change with the next 3 or 4.
Right. Right. You know, inside that next 5% or 10% or 50% is a whole new market, you know, for another day. You know, when it gets large enough to be interesting, the 95% inside that will be the same size.
Or it may never be. It might just be
right.
We're there, right? We never need anything better than that. There's another interesting thing, and this ties into what you're doing on your boats. You know, whatever the size and shape of these greenhouses are, once they become more or less self-sustaining and self-propagating, and you have that energy problem solved, you have the recycling problem solved and all this stuff, the humidity, all the environmental controls, at that point, you're ready to be anywhere. You're ready to be in outer space. You're ready to be on a boat. And so this other sort of longer term picture of humanity populating, you know, Mars and other planets and then the stars ultimately depends on our ability to do that. And so one of the really fascinating things, if you look at this as a futurist, not as a science fictionist, is that we are actually advancing each of these different things that we need if humanity is going to survive, you know, the eventual collapse of the Earth into the sun.
Well, right. You know, these sort of things give me faith. As you say, every day, you know, 80% of my time is spent on these boats now, right? And they make their own water out of the air, same as the greenhouse does. They make electricity out of the sun so far, and there's other energy streams. They get propulsion through various means. And, you know, this, you know, putting something like that on a boat, you know, of course, is, you know, a topic of conversation in my little aquatic world, because that's the only thing that would keep a self-sustained, you know, community offshore.
All right, so let me tell you a little bit more, because one of the things that they develop and they have the ability to build is they can put an entire operation into 2 containers, you know, the containers that go on container ships. So when it comes to deployment, you know, they can put it into a container and put it on a ship and literally have that container on the ship go and grow whatever they're growing and generate the energy and do all the other stuff in the feedback loop that you need for some sustainability level. And they were talking about doing that, and they, you know, did a prototype. And it worked. So you could have a rapid deployment, grow food somewhere, although the food still takes time to grow. So, you know, rapid deployment compared to having food the next day, not quite. But they did the analysis, they did the experiment, and they figured out, no, not yet. Maybe right. Someday. But nope, right now the optimum path is this. We're going to take that optimum path. But yes, they can already do this on boats and in containers and so forth.
And of course, these are the worst jokes of 2022 when it comes to cyber. How bad are these jokes? These jokes are so bad we couldn't even get the laugh track to laugh at them. Why did the computer show up late to work? Well, it had a hard drive. What's the biggest lie in the entire universe? The answer, I have read and agreed to the terms and conditions. Someone cracked my password. Now I need to rename my puppy. Yeah, for me personally, cloud security isn't really a worry, you know, because my data is in such a mess, no one would be able to find anything anyway. Hey, tough it up, buddy. The Prince of Nigeria is sad too. No one falls for his emails anymore. What happens in Vegas ends up on YouTube. Hey, why aren't iPhone chargers called Apple Juice? You know what? If computers get too powerful, we can just organize them into committees and then they won't be able to get anything done. Do you know how many programmers it takes to change a light bulb? Well, zero. It's a hardware problem. Coming up before the end of the show, the best joke of the year.
Now, on to our next service provider.
Ira, welcome back. We started to talk about social engineering. Now let's talk about, so how many years did you do social engineering, which, as you describe, is lying over the phone, but you can be lying in person too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I got a reputation for doing black bag operations where I would go with, you know, actual former Russian spies, former CIA operatives, Navy SEALs, and we'd infiltrate companies physically. You know, obviously there'd still be some part to do it over the telephone, but it was more notable to be able to go on site and literally talk people out of information. And, you know, like I once got a, this was funny. I once had a secretary kick the CEO off of his own computer so I could sit down at his computer. And it was like,
I love it. Okay. Yeah. We got to repair it. We have to fix it before, you know, computer repair. That's a piece. They still use computer repair, you know.
Well, the actual pretext was I had to check to make sure the antivirus software was up to date.
Yeah, computer repair. Computer repair. So we used to do this. We did this for all sorts of corporations. Starting at the outside, you know, you look for the cigarette butts outside the door, and you just hang out. And if you want to have a badge, we had different ways of making up phony badges or getting real badges from people, but you hang out next to the door. They come out to smoke. You smoke with them and you walk back in with them. So now you're inside. Mm-hmm. And then you just walk around and do almost anything you want, talk to people and so forth. And the other one was look like, you know, so we would make sure that we dressed appropriate. So we looked like other people that belong there. One place in Europe, I ended up, a guy was having problems going in the building because he had these big boxes. So I just offered to take one of the boxes. Sure. So he walks in, shows his badge, and I sort of made it look like I had a badge. They just let me through. Mm-hmm. And we did this with the guy who was in charge following me in, just, you know, sort of shaking his head saying, oh, God, you can't believe it. This, you know, it's all the securities in place. It all works right. You carry a box, you're done. No problem.
I actually had one guy, I think I gave him whiplash because I was breaking into this one company. And what happened was this one guy in charge of their security operations, he vowed I would never be able to get into his building. And what happened was I ended up. I like basically made up some story that I knew somebody was on vacation. And I said, I'm an auditor. I need to speak to so-and-so. And they're like, oh, so-and-so's not here. I'm like, is there somebody else who can help me? We have to prepare for an audit coming up. And I need to count the number of systems that are inside the operation center. And can so-and-so, if I show up, can somebody please escort me? So anyway, I got somebody to take me in and we did a count. Well, you know, they weren't paying attention, but I a pair to count the servers that they had in the room. And then what happened was as
you open the boxes and touch them to count them. So
yeah,
of course.
And then as we were walking out, all of a sudden, the guy that vowed I would never get into his building, as he saw me shake hands and leave, all of a sudden he's like, look, you know, like, cause he knew what I look like. And he couldn't say anything. But as I was leaving, all of a sudden he's like, he's just walked by and then his like head swung around and I thought he was going to break his neck because it swung so fast. But that was kind of
fun. If we start talking about this stuff though, so you talked about having, you know, the folks from foreign intelligence operations with you. Did you actually do that or was that just reputation?
No, I mean, Stan, for example, he was a colonel in the GRU and he was, I mean, you could tell he was a true spy master in the things he found, the way he found them. I mean, he had a sixth sense for people who would be questionable. For example, there was one time, he would bother me with things like, it's like, he'd ask questions with his, and then I'm like, Stan, just take the keys to the car. Go find out for yourself. Because I was like busy doing other things. Then he'd come back in like 3 hours later. He goes, 40% off sale, Lord and Taylor's. I'm like, what the? And he's like, Ira, half the company, Lord and Taylor's today. And so he was there. And then there was another time, you know, he called me up.
Did you ever get into physical aspects of penetration? Like having people with special skills go in through ducts or go up to, you know, higher floors or parachute in or go underground or anything like that?
Well, if you have to do that, then at some point it's like, what are they going to do to stop it? Because part of being part of doing these pen tests, you have to be a security professional first. You have to find things that, for example, a reasonable intruder would go through and we would never have had to resort to that. It's like, why try to, for example, use zero-day attacks when all you have to do is call up and ask for a password?
Right.
Why try to do, you know, go through?
Well, so I'll answer your question, right? So what we were trying to do, getting in is too easy, right? Getting in takes a couple minutes, you win. I mean, and almost always works. And the other thing, we made a rule for ourselves that we weren't allowed to lie. So we would always tell the truth. So it's more fun, but you still get in.
Well, I work with a Navy SEAL and God, Stu was, he had his ways of doing things, you know, really. Because here's the thing about intelligence and special forces operatives. You know, essentially at the end of the day, what you do is you go through 2 to 3 years of training, depending on where you're at. And essentially what they're training you to do is how to rapidly recognize vulnerabilities and how to rapidly exploit it.
Yeah.
And Stu had this way of doing it. If it was physical, there was nobody I would trust more to have a bomb on their back following me into a building or leading me into a building than Stu. At the same time, Stu was the nicest guy you'd ever meet. And he was a terrible liar. And so if we ever got to a point where it's like, you know, see, there was one time where, and it was kind of funny, we were breaking into this facility and we pretty much got everything. And then what happened was we walked by this one guy's office who turned out to be the ops manager. And we convinced the facility person to escort us all the way through.
Of course. Anyway, that makes it legitimate.
Yeah. As we're in the last target, all of a sudden, the facilities guy gets a call and it's like, I don't know, just some guys from corporate. I don't know. And then I hear it. Then he's like, well, that's my ops manager. He saw us walk by his office and he wants to talk to you. So anyway, he's like, OK, I'm just going to leave you here in the lobby. And Stu turns to me. He's like, should we make a run for it? I'm like, oh,
no,
God, no. And then he's like, what are we going to do?
You're telling the same story you told the last guy.
Well, no, he's like, what are we going to do? I go, I'm not sure yet. And so what happened was the guy comes over and he's like, well, how are you? How come, you know, and then he's like, how come nobody told me you were coming here? And what I did was I made up a story that said, well, somebody fell down in a server room because they tripped over a cable. And we're supposed to go around to all the server rooms and telecom closets to make sure there's no cables that are loose and everything.
Right. Right. And then so he's like, oh, okay, go away. Yeah.
And then the guy's like, well, how come nobody ever told me you were coming? And so,
they didn't tell you.
What I realized was he was not upset that we were possibly robbing him.
No, he was upset about his position and not being informed.
Right. He was upset that we did not kiss his ring. So basically, I'm like, I don't know. And then he's like, well, who can I call to complain about this? I actually gave him the guy's contact who we were working with. And this was the East Coast of the U.S. The headquarters was on the West Coast of the U.S. This was about 8:30 in the morning.
Yeah, and so it's too early to call. So, it's 5:30. He's not going to call until later if he calls at all, right?
Yeah. And so anyway, pretty much he's like, well, I'm going to call and complain that nobody informed me. I'm like, okay. So anyway, then we were back on, and I'm near BWI because I live near Annapolis, and Stu was with me because he lives in Annapolis too. And we were, as I was walking through the airport, I get a call from the guy in California. Now, this was 3 hours, 4 hours later.
Yeah.
And the guy was on the phone. He's like, Ira, why does this person call me? I told him what happened. And he's like, what should I do? I go, what would you normally do if this guy called you? He's like, I would ignore it because he's kind of an ass. Ignore it and see what he does. But just for the record, I want it noted, I am now 300 miles away. Miles away, just for the record. So anyway, that was kind of the whole, that was an interesting test.
I mean, the stories themselves are as Hollywood epic as they sound, right? And you and I have been through these professionally, right? But I love the whole social engineering thing. You know, when I was 15, I'd hit a growth spurt and, didn't know anything about computers and hacking, didn't consider it hacking, but it was, right? Because I got my hands on a railway worker's yellow plastic hard hat. And with that and a pair of work
boots. Game over.
Oh, yeah. Walk in, walk out, free rides. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So social learned in getting it behind the scenes, just that attitude, right, is just so much fun. Oh, God.
So one of the challenges I have in dealing with this is there are so many replies you could give, right? It's not like you can train somebody and here's the circumstance and here's what you're going to do. And Ira's just right. And the guy says, what are we going to do? Run away. And Ira says, well, I don't know yet. Let's see what he says. So the whole concept of it's self-confidence, not being worried, not stressed. If you're stressed, if you're worried, you look like it. They can tell, just like a dog, can tell. People can tell if something's wrong with you. So there's something about believing in yourself and trusting in yourself, or maybe it's just naivete.
Well, the Terry Pratchett book, Going Postal, has a great character, Moist von Liebig, and he is a scammer, right? And in his narration, he explains how alive he is, sitting there with the forged document, sitting calmly. It's not the running. It's sitting there with your artwork sitting on the desk and the banker on the other side of the desk and just waiting. And that's the essence of it. It is. It's exciting. It's a lot of fun. And this is something across our community. Young hackers.
But also, this is nothing like new in any way. No. I just was watching a movie. I think it was from the 1930s. About an ad man, right? And it's a really well-known movie. I don't want to get into the details of the movie, but basically he starts out, he has $50 left in the world. He goes to the fanciest hotel in the downtown New York and checks in and he's tipping everybody, he has, there's one guy he's going to give a tip to who says, no, you're going to get a job. Tip me after you get the job. So he takes the money for the tip and he throws it out the window. And the other guy says, why'd you throw it out the window? He said, because, I have to have the right attitude that it means nothing. The only way I'm going to get the job is by not wanting it, not needing it.
Right.
And it, of course, it works. I mean, it's a movie, but the reality is it's just like that. And so you see all these scams in the movies. The one problem is they get too fancy.
Right.
Well, because it's almost always the simple answer.
You know, and in the cybersecurity community gives me a lot of hope in humanity because, you know, there's, you know, LulzSec. Remember LulzSec? You know, I forget exactly what they did, but they got real famous. And one of the folks.
And dissipated, went to jail, right?
Yeah. So I met one of these guys in London. And that was waiting for the final, you know, sentencing to come through. Smoking cigarettes out of a Soho bar in an alleyway late at night. He's hearing stories. And he's saying, look, you know, I was a young guy. And I'm just finding out I could just pop open cash drawers. So I didn't take the money. But you can only make it possible for me to pop open the cash drawers. They're going to pop open the cash drawers. You know, I didn't, you know, look to do any harm. I was, you know, in the professional life. You know, we, as you say, we have codes of conduct and so forth. If you look back at, you know, most of us hacker folks, we could have done bad things, we didn't. We're just curious. Just, can I get back there? Can I stand there? Can I pop open that cash drawer? Right.
Well, the other thing is, you know, I won't do this for fun. It's a professional activity, right? I don't lie for fun, right? I won't take advantage of other people because it's not my nature to do that. You know, that's, I'm trying to be honest and sincere in everything I do and be good to other people. But as a profession, it's completely the opposite.
Well, for everybody out there not in cybersecurity, you should take this as a sign of hope, you know, that everything works. You know, the lights basically stay on. And time after time again, you know, cybersecurity and in other aspects of the world show how easy it is to scam the system. But most people don't. Most of the time, most people who can don't. If they did, we would have to implement different security. The fact that in our career had to build different security shows that most people aren't trying to break it most of the time.
No, society would not work. This is the fundamental flaw behind zero trust and this whole notion of not trusting people. If 50% of people are not trustworthy, then society collapses. You cannot exist in a world where you can't trust that walking across the street, a car is not going to go hit you.
And most people walk up to it on the street and say, wait, hold my wallet, I got to run inside. And you come back and your wallet's still there. I mean, how many people, I've lost my wallet, I think, once in my adult life, twice. And it was sent back to me. You know, that's what most people do, just because.
Most people are honest. Most people are good.
Getting time without the cash in it, but you know, what the hell.
And that's by the way, that's why the bad guys can get away with it, because we trust them. And so I want to get back to the fraud, spies, and lies series. So most of these things are readily identifiable things that say this has got to be a fraud, right? The too good to be true. Oh, I'll give you $1 million if you just lend me a dime, you know. Well, okay, for a dime, I'll take the risk. Well, I don't care. I'll just give you the dime anyway. Forget the $1 million. But it's always more money than that. You know, it's like $400 for a license to something on Microsoft that you're now overdue on and you have to use your PayPal account when you don't actually pay anything for $400 to Microsoft or anything you've ever bought. I don't even use Microsoft. But so you can detect them, but you actually have to get over that. I'll not call it naivete, over that excessive trust in everything and everybody when it comes to certain acts like giving away your money or your password, right?
Well, I think Pratt does a great job with Moise von Ludwig. You know, because in the narration, he explains his morality about this, that, you know, what he's really doing is exploiting people's, you know, they're culpable. You know, if you really, really want to believe glass is a diamond and you're suddenly going to get a chance to buy one at 10% its price because, you know, then it's really your fault.
It's not. It's the nature of cognitive errors,
right?
That people professionally learn to induce and suppress signals to generate, and you get those cognitive errors. And some people take advantage of them in an unfair way, and that's called a fraud. And other people are, you know, lying for other purposes, you know, to gain other advantages over you.
Well, and more play in the book, he learns that lesson in the end, right? You know, but it is interesting. You know, we're only exploitable where we really kind of would like things to be true that aren't going to be true.
So the article from December on all.net is called Crime Pays. And that's the fact, right?
Yep.
Very few criminals end up in jail. Most of them earn a living. Some of them earn a very good living. Some of them get very wealthy and then avoid those crimes or find, you know, other ways to get away with it or get past the statute of limitations. So, all right, great.
And I have my dirty criminals, not because it doesn't work, is because they don't want it. It's a hassle. You have to want to live with that sort of lifestyle. It's just easier not to for most people.
Well, once you have $1 billion, why are you going to bother? Well, because it's fun, because I like taking advantage of people, because my personality. All right. So, you know, that's just how it is. All right, moving right along. Of course, if we're going to be reviewing cyber jokes from 2022, we're going to have to come up with a winner. And this year, it wasn't even close. After a thorough examination of the events of 2022, we have determined that the cyber joke of the year for 2022 was... Elon Musk! Next week on The Cyber Show, we tear a bite out of SD cards. Kevin goes willy-nilly on warrants. Sean blows through billions. Ira tells us what he knows others don't know. Peter pulls his punches with no memory. Wynn goes into the Highlands with Harold. And Sin starts without Sin. Only here on The Cyber Show.
A good time, and foul. A good time. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time was had by all.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.